You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Scott Kaiser. He's a nationally recognized master teacher of acting and voice, as well as a director, playwright, and author. For 28 seasons, Scott served as a member of the artistic staff at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival right here in Ashland, where he directed, adapted, coached, or performed in every play in Shakespeare's canon. Scott is the author of more than 20 books, which include novels, short stories, instructional guides to acting Shakespeare, and numerous plays and adaptations for the stage. His latest book is titled Conquering the Canon, A Life in Shakespeare. Welcome to the Exchange, Scott.
Thank you, Mike.
Let's start by clearing up the controversy that may be of concern to some Bard fans. How many plays are in the Shakespeare canon?
Yes, that's very, very fluid these days. As I say in my book, I count it as 38. I was born in the late 50s, so in my mind it's 38. There's a lot of plays that folks would like to add to the canon, but I think there's very much a commercial motive for that, that it's very... if we have to sell the brand new complete works and there's an extra play in it, that benefits us financially. Or if somebody thinks they can get their PhD by writing a paper claiming that Shakespeare wrote this other play or that he collaborated with so-and-so on this other play. So there's a real profit motive behind, I think, adding plays to the canon. And a commercial motivation for that as well. And of course, the scholarship wants to move forward. But in my mind, it's 38. That's the number I've stuck with, and I'll probably go to my grave with that number.
The Riverside edition added a 39th.
Yes, they did. The edition I always use is from my my teenage years, which is the G. Blakemore Evans Riverside, the first edition, I think 1974. And it's true that in 1997, they added the reign of King Edward III, which supposedly has substantial contributions from Shakespeare. The scholarship is very fluid about that. I've never quite accepted the reign of King Edward III as part of the canon. And to be perfectly frank, that has a lot to do with the fact that OSF down the street has never adopted it either. They've never done a production of King Edward III at OSF. So my canon actually matches the one down the street. When the festival decides that they want to produce King Edward III, then I may at that point decide that it's part of the canon. But until then, the festival says we've done the canon four times, and they've never done it with the third. So I'm very much in line with the festival.
When you were young, you had this dream of performing in all of the Shakespeare plays. Take me back to that time. What inspired you?
Well, as I talk about in that book, I was a 15-year-old, and I wasn't interested really in acting at all, but I was in a high school program that had, like so many high school programs, more young women than men, and I started to get dragged onto the stage in larger and larger parts. At one point, I was cast as Bottom in A Midsummer Night's Dream, and that kind of was my first experience with acting Shakespeare and with the Shakespearean script in production, and that's what really got me started. Because it was fun, and I had a facility with it. Even at that age, I understood it. It made sense to me. It didn't seem like a foreign language to me. But as I say in the book, one of my main motivations at that point in acting in Shakespeare was it was a great way to meet high school girls. I mean, I was 15 and no one had ever paid any attention to me. And then suddenly I'm in a scene surrounded by fairies and, you know, Titania. And it was lovely to finally be noticed in high school. It really set my identity very early on.
Why did you write this book?
Well, I started at 15, and I finished my canon, some 40 years later. So it occupied the vast majority of my professional career and my academic career and as a student. So for me to try to chronicle what I had done, how I'd managed to get through all of the plays, you know, in various positions wearing different hats, but also I'm just very aware that there's almost no literature out there that I can think of that I know of about working on the canon as a practitioner. So, you know, there are many scholarly works about the entire canon, Harold Bloom, Marjorie Garber, being the two major works. But there really aren't a lot of books about what it is to work through the canon as a practitioner, you know, as a director, as an assistant director, as an actor, as a fight director, as a vocal person. So that's the different take on the book. And as I say, I think what makes it unique is that there aren't a lot of practitioners who make it all the way through the canon. And there's a reason for that. It's because so few theaters have the wherewithal to produce the odd ducks. You know, I mean, when I worked at OSF, they were able to produce Timon of Athens and Two Noble Kinsmen and Coriolanus and Troilus and Cressida, but most practitioners never get to do those shows because the economics don't work for most theaters.
Okay. And so this book, when you wrote it from behind the scenes, and you give us a sense of what it's like behind the scenes for each of these plays. I love that. How would you describe your book?
Well, every chapter is a little different depending on what my experience with the play was, but I do go through the entire canon. And if I was an actor, I talk about being an actor in the show, or if I was a voice and text person, I talk about the text of the show and what the challenges were, or if I was an adapter, I would talk about the difficulties of adapting this particular script, or if I was trying to direct it, talking about what it's like to approach the script as a director. But it's always hands-on. It's always rehearsal room or preparing for a rehearsal room or watching it in rehearsal or watching it in performance in front of people and realizing what you'd set out to accomplish hadn't really turned out the way you'd hoped or had turned out better than you'd hoped. But as I say, it's not about sitting in a library and looking at it from a critical angle. I talk about the tools that I acquired in my professional life and how I attempted to apply them to production, which again makes it a very, very different kind of book than what is currently out there.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Scott Kaiser, author of Conquering the Canon, A Life in Shakespeare. So tell me about the four parts into which you divided the book.
Well, the four parts, that's very traditional to divide the book into comedies, tragedies, histories, and romances. Oddly, people think when they go to folio, they look for the romance section. There is no romance section in the folio of 1623. That category was invented, in the 1870s by a critic who said, you know, these plays don't really fit, even though they were jammed into the first folio in one of the three other categories, comedy, tragedies, or histories. The scholar's particular insight was that some of these plays don't really fit, and so he invented the category of romance, and we've been using that category ever since. And I went ahead and honored that. But that is not a Shakespearean category. Romance is only about 150 years old as a category for the plays. And just to be clear to your listeners, that's Two Noble Kinsmen, The Tempest, Cymbeline, Winter's Tale, the late plays that emphasize forgiveness, and lost daughters, and storms at sea, and Pericles is the one I just missed. Yeah,
where does Romeo and Juliet?
Very much a tragedy. Yeah,
it really is. Well, Shakespeare was a wordsmith, and to love Shakespeare, it seems to me that you would have to love the power of the spoken word to evoke emotion. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, If you look down my book list, I actually wrote an entire book called Shakespeare's Wordcraft. It's a very geeky book about how Shakespeare uses rhetoric in all of his plays. It's supposed to be an actor-friendly book, and I do teach out of it quite a bit, but it goes through all the rhetorical devices from the simplest to the most complex and how Shakespeare uses his knowledge of rhetoric to help his characters get what they want. So it's very compatible with Stanislavski theory that says every character is pursuing something. We as a modern culture don't really understand rhetoric because we don't have a lot of speakers nowadays who use it. I think Barack Obama may have been the last speaker. Jesse Jackson used it, but he's now since passed. There's no one in our current lives who uses rhetorical devices anywhere near what Shakespeare understood them to be. And Shakespeare was steeped in rhetoric as a student in Stratford-upon-Avon, and he used that knowledge and that gift for rhetoric throughout the plays. When we look at the plays with our modern eyes, we skip over it. We barely see it because we're not used to it. We don't see it and we don't hear it in our modern culture.
In Love's Labor's Lost, there's a 13-syllable word that I cannot pronounce.
I'll do it for you if you like.
Go for it.
Okay. Honorific abilitudinitatibus.
One more time.
Honorific abilitudinitatibus.
What does that mean?
I'm trying to remember the exact definition of it, but it's the state of being The state of being able to accept honors.
Oh, and that's the
honorific actor. Part is.
and I think the character was Costard.
It's Costard. It's Costard, who is a clown in Love's Labour's Lost, and it comes out of his mouth, and it even surprises him when it comes out of his mouth. But it's the longest word in Shakespeare, and a delightful word at that.
And this is a comedy.
It's a comedy.
Now, how do you plug a word like that, 13 syllables, into a comedy and get a laugh?
Well, the issue for me is that people misunderstand Love's Labour's Lost, and they misunderstand it because in most modern productions, it is so heavily cut. Love's Labour's Lost uncut runs over 3 hours, but most directors want it to be kind of a rom-com-y, sort of flighty, light, and frothy play. So they cut a lot of the dialogue that is actually about rhetoric. The play is actually about wordplay. Nothing happens in Love's Labour's Lost. Absolutely nothing happens. But what happens is the characters kind of outword each other. It's a competition of, you know, language. It's Shakespeare as a very young playwright showing his rhetorical ability in a romance. And we rarely get that in a theater because it's so heavily cut. The reason honorific abilitudine tatibus belongs in the play is because it's a character showing off their language ability, their facility with language and with words. That happens throughout the play. Normally, it comes to us now. You could look at the Branagh film, for example. It's I think it's an hour and 50, and it's just sort of a frothy post-war comedy. But the language play is brutalized in most productions of Love's Labour's.
When you say it's brutalized, what do you mean?
I mean it's cut. It's cut heavily. 30% or more of that language play is cut out of the play. Audience doesn't see it. They don't hear it.
Well, we're used to 90-minute movies, two-hour movies. You throw a three-hour movie in front of us, and that's tough. You're talking about a three-hour play.
Yeah. Well, again, in the book, I talk about a production of Love's Labour's Lost that I did at the festival that was directed by a gentleman named Kelm Albers. And his production concept was, if we're going to do the play, let's do the play. And what he did was he didn't cut it at all. And that was one of my privileges at the festival, that it was a three-hour-plus Love's Labour's Lost, which is unheard of. Ken felt that the festival's integrity and reputation meant that we could get away with a full-length, three-hour-plus Love's Labour's Lost, that our audiences would sit for it. And Ken's whole way of directing that play was to ask, how can we make this very obscure language play, a joke that's 400 years old, how can we make it clear to an audience? So instead of immediately cutting it, assuming an audience wouldn't understand it, he took the opposite approach and said, what can we do? How can we stage this so that our audience will understand the language play here? And it was a really extraordinary production in that regard, that it was about honoring what was on the page instead of saying, our audiences won't get it. We just have to push the bar down until they can have an enjoyable evening, you know.
And the outcome?
I thought the outcome was highly successful. I think we did the play, and I'm proud of it.
Okay. Well, in this era of AI, and everything is truncated and short, and our attention spans are almost gone, do you think that play could be done again?
In its entirety?
Yeah.
Oh, dear. I think it's much harder to pull it off in its entirety now. I really do. It would take a very rare team of director, dramaturg, voice and text director, artistic director who's willing to take that risk. The risk is working with an audience that doesn't have the patience for that kind of language play. I mean, modern audiences now, they do not have the listening ability that they even had 25 years ago. And I often liken this to, we can watch a movie or watch a streaming, a streaming video, and the shots are coming at you, you know, less than a second, bang, 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 the rapid fire. And we have developed an ability to digest a huge amount of visual information that's coming at us rapidly. And I think what people don't understand is that in Shakespeare's day, even going back to the radio days, all the way back to, you know, when radio was still prevalent, we were good listeners. And we could digest auditory information very, very quickly and at a very, very sophisticated level. We have lost that ability. So to answer your question, I think it's very difficult for an audience to take in the entirety of Love's Labor is Lost because they don't actually have the skill any longer to listen attentively and appreciate the language play that's going on in the plays for that length of time.
Okay. On that note, we're going to have to take a short break. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Scott Kaiser, author of Conquering the Canon, A Life in Shakespeare. Scott spent more than 30 years with the Oregon Shakespeare Festival here in Ashland and achieved his dream of working on all 38 of the plays in the Shakespeare canon. Scott, you chose Ashland over pursuing opportunities in New York on Broadway, much to the chagrin of your advisor at the University of Washington. Tell me why.
Well, when I was in training as an actor, my particular talent was in the classics. I was never, given my voice and my body, I was never going to be, you know, the next young heartthrob in television or film. And in Broadway at the time, I was a young character man, so even in theaters, I was very hard to place. So when I got this opportunity at the festival, it seemed to be a really good fit for me. It was what I was interested in. It was what I was good at. And I wasn't willing to wait until I was in my 40s for my career to take off. Even my mentor would say, you know, Scott, your career is not going to take off until you're middle-aged, and then you'll be playing lawyers and doctors and, you know, and professionals. So I just wasn't willing to wait 15 years to reach my prime. So when the offer came to work at OSF, I grabbed it and I came down here and I started my career in the classical theater. And that's what I did with my life.
So in your book, you take us behind the scenes of OSF, a professional theater with one of the biggest operating budgets in America, you say. Can you give us a sense of where OSF fits in the ecosystem of the industry of live theater?
Well, it's really changed over the past 5 or 6 years. Post-pandemic, I think the theater world is a very, very different place, and that includes OSF. I haven't been an employee there in maybe 8 years, so I don't know the inner workings of what's going on there. But I do know that the theater is undergoing enormous changes right now, and the festival is absolutely part of that changing ecosystem. I won't get too specific, but if you compare a season from the 80s or 90s, let's say, to a season this year or last year or the year before, the offerings are very, very different. The focus is very, very different. And the economics have changed enormously. And so, and Tim Bond, who I know and admire, is adjusting to a new economic reality in the American theater.
Well, you wrote about some people that you met when you first came to OSF. And I'd like for you, if you would, to tell me about Larry Paulson. He's in your book on page 23, if you just read a quick paragraph.
It says, the opportunity to observe Larry was, in my mind, exactly why I had chosen Ashland over Manhattan, to be a part of a resident acting company. Like a teaching hospital, the underlying unspoken ethos of the company was watch one, do one, teach one. And so as a young character man, I thought of understudying Larry as a privilege, not a chore. It meant that I could watch him from the wings, sponging up his every gesture and inflection. And that doesn't happen when you assemble a cast of strangers to rehearse and perform a play for 3 months in, say, Syracuse or Louisville, and then send them all home the moment their contracts expire.
How did you feel after being part of this OSF the first year and watching Larry?
Well, I'd been an actor in training for years, but to actually be in a professional company to watch how seasoned professionals, veteran classical actors actually applied the tools that I'd been learning, that was a big lesson. It's one thing to learn it in a studio with fellow students, and in theory, this is how you might handle this or how you might solve that or how you might use your voice or how you might use your body. But to look at a 10 or 12-year veteran classical actor and go, oh, I see. That's the way he made that turn. Or, oh, look at the way he landed that joke. Or wow, the rhythm that was. I didn't expect that from the page that would be the rhythm that would get him a laugh. Or, oh, listen to how he really finessed that operative word so we could hear it in a 1,200-seat theater. Also, you have to keep in mind that when I arrived in 1985, the OSF, that was not only was it not mic'd, we didn't have a balcony. All 1,200 seats were essentially on that concrete pad, so unmiked and going back all the way up to Hargadine Street. So it was a much, much more difficult venue than it is now. And watching the veterans work to be heard and understood in a very, very challenging outdoor space was a gift.
You didn't have any FOMO, fear of missing out in New York?
Well, I wasn't missing out, and I knew I wasn't missing out because I wasn't going to get hired. I knew that. I said, I mean, as I said, even my mentor knew that I wasn't going to start a career. So I admired film and television actors, but I just knew that wasn't my path. It wasn't my path. If I'd gone back in my 40s or my 50s, I would have had to start from scratch, but then I might have been castable as a middle-aged to older man. I'm more castable now, Mike, in New York than I ever was when I was 25. Because I'm the judge. I'm the Supreme Court judge. I'm the chief of police. I'm the prosecutor, you know, the prosecuting attorney. I'm the psychologist. That's how I'd get cast now. Tons of roles for guys like me, if you can remember your lines.
Central casting is calling.
Yes, exactly.
So Barry Craft,
yes,
is someone who was very influential as well. You write about him. Can you give us a short excerpt?
Well, like me, Barry Craft was someone who was at the festival for many, many years. And Barry was a very close colleague of mine for years and years. Let me see if I can find. Barry was not only an actor, he was a brilliant Shakespeare dramaturg and scholar who served on nearly 50 Shakespearean productions at OSF. For more than 20 seasons, from 1993 to 2013, Barry and I worked on dozens of shows together, with Barry serving as dramaturg and me as voice and text director, wrestling with such formidable texts as Hamlet, Lear, Othello, Macbeth, Richard III, Coriolanus, Troilus and Cressida, and many others. But I'll talk much more about that richly rewarding collaboration in the Hamlet chapter. Throughout the book, I talk about working with Barry. And the reason for that is Barry, really more than anybody in my working career, taught me a great deal about what it is to love Shakespeare on a daily basis. He was so generous about sharing his knowledge of Shakespeare, excited to let you know, did you see this? Did you know that? Yeah, let me share a fact with you. Absolutely enormously generous with the knowledge he knew about Shakespeare. Sitting next to Barry in rehearsal was something I look forward to every day, because it was like having a personal mentor just sitting at your side. Every single day I would learn something. I never went home without learning something new from Barry. And I can't speak highly enough of him.
That's amazing. My guest is Scott Keiser, author of Conquering the Canon, A Life in Shakespeare. Now, looking back across those 38 Shakespeare plays that you've been fortunate enough to work on, can you identify any favorites?
I always hedge my bets on this question, Mike, because sometimes your favorite plays will be badly produced, and sometimes plays you don't think well of will be well produced. So I try to link the answer to that question to an "it depends" answer. You know, who's producing it? Who's in it? Is there a remarkable actor in it? Has it been directed in an innovative and imaginative way? So I often avoid this question because I've seen both extremes. Plays I would say, you know, I don't really like that play, and then a production surprises me. And then plays I think, oh, this is my favorite. And then I get home and I go, oh, that was miserable.
Okay, well, actors are arguably human. They make mistakes. What happens on stage when there's a mistake?
Well, this is one of the wonderful things about working with veterans. You know, when you work with an actor who's done 10 seasons, 15 seasons, 20 seasons, 25 seasons, those actors can make their mistakes. One, they can hide them. And if they can't hide them, they can approach the mistake with a level of humility that enables the audience to forgive the mistake. I won't go into anecdotes because there's so many of them, and I don't want to embarrass anybody by them. But I've seen so many wonderfully gifted actors just sort of cover their tracks in an extremely humble way. More often than not, an audience member is not aware that a word has been missed, or a line has been missed, or a cue has been jumped, or a cue has been lost, or an entrance is a hair later than it should have been, or a prop didn't behave the way it should have. Being a seasoned actor means covering your tracks. And I think when you've worked in rehearsal, you see these actors at the festival become extremely adept at hiding the mistakes from the audience. Mostly you don't even notice them.
Well, you work as a team. So if one member of the team makes a mistake, they can't just cover it by themselves. As a team, everyone has to work on that.
Huh? It's true. It's very true. I mean, there are many, many instances where a prop will take on a life of its own and fall off a table, or, you know, a letter will suddenly fly out of one's hands. And yeah, and then the other actor will, of course, pick up the prop on the way out, right? Oh, so-and-so lost a scarf. There it is. I'm on my way out. I think I'll pick it up and I'll take it off stage with me. You see that all the time. Absolutely. Team thinking, which, of course, that is what it is to be a repertory ensemble, that you cover each other's tracks. The only thing you can really liken it to is like being in the Marines, which is when you're in a repertory ensemble, you literally, you have the back of that person who's on stage with you, and they know you have their back, and it makes for a performance experience that is very much unlike what you see in a house where we hire people from New York to be with us for a couple of months and then go home. The festival's very intangible quality of being a repertory acting company member is how everybody is making sure that everybody's okay.
So it's like a family.
I wouldn't call it a family because it still is a profession.
Well, you've had an opportunity to work with a wide variety of diverse people, personalities, and characters. What lessons have you learned about working so closely with teams of actors and the pressure of performing on stage?
Like I said, one of the things that makes the OSF very, very special and unique is the longevity of the performers. And it's just when you have worked with each other in a room and perform with one another in productions, 10, 20, 25, 30 Shakespearean productions over decades, there's a rapport that happens. And the only way you can understand this is what it must have been like for the sitcom actors having done the 100th Seinfeld or, you know, the 75th Big Bang Theory. Or there's an ease and a grace that happens between actors that, oh, I understand where he's going with that moment. Or, oh, he's timing that the way he normally does. I'm just going to give him a little bit more time, a little bit more grace. Or, oh, we're going to ride this laugh, right? We're going to let this laugh ride. And right, there's all this unspoken rapport that happens in a company that doesn't happen in companies where you've been hired and you're just learning the people you're working with as performers. It's a very, very different experience. There's a trust there. There's a rapport there. And all that unspoken shared language that happens on the stage, an audience can't tell you exactly what it is, but I think it brings audiences back year after year because there's an intangible that they perceive is a little bit different. And that's what draws, I think, audiences back. You know, ensemble rapport is unique at the festival.
Okay, well, I have saved my hardest question for the last 2 minutes. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
What do you imagine Shakespeare will be like in the era of AI?
Wow, that's an intriguing question. I think AI is changing everything. I think that's a pretty obvious statement. I anticipate that as the American theater recovers, and it's already doing this, I expect that Shakespeare will become more and more multimedia and frankly, I think more visual than it is. I think we're very close to a visual enhancement of Shakespeare so that people can understand it as well as hear the language. And I had an epiphany. I might as well just share this with your listeners. I had an epiphany. I went to something at the Hollywood Bowl. It was the Lord of the Rings movies put up on screen while the symphony played. So it was multimedia. It wasn't just going to the symphony to listen to the Lord of the Rings. We saw scenes from the movies on these massive LED screens. And I think ultimately, Shakespeare is probably going to go that way. You'll walk into a theater and it'll be loaded with large screens. There'll be live camera people following the actors around, you know, and then the words will actually be printed in super titles as the actors speak. I think it's going to become much more multimedia. It can't become that right now because the money isn't there. But it would only take a billionaire to throw, you know, a substantial contribution at a theater for us to start moving into multimedia Shakespeare, where it's not just a watching a tiny little Romeo and a tiny little Juliet from the balcony, you know, and having their voices pumped up through speakers. It'll be, you'll see them on multiple screens. You'll see them from multiple angles. You'll see the language printed above them. And then even you could do the pop-up bubble thing where, okay, I know you didn't know what that honorific abilitudinitatibus means, so we're going to put the definition up there on the screen up on your right. We're going to tell you what that means right now. So what that would do is make the audience engage at multiple streams of information simultaneously, the way we do now with our computers with six windows open. That's where I think it's going.
I got to tell you, I would love to see that right here in Ashland at OSF, but we're out of time. Thank you so much for writing this book, and thank you for your work.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
My guest was Scott Kaiser, author of Conquering the Canon, A Life in Shakespeare. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.